Chapter 7. Moscow, Russia's favourite daughter, where is your equal to be found? Dmitriev. Can one not love our native Moscow? Baratinsky. Speak ill of Moscow? So this is what it means to see the world? Where is it better then? Where we are not. Griboyedov. Spring rays at last begin to muster and chase from nearby hills the snow, whose turbid streams flow down and cluster to inundate the fields below. And drowsy nature, smiling lightly, now greets the dawning season brightly. The heavens sparkle now with blue, the still transparent woods renew their downy green and start to thicken. The bee flies out from waxen cell to claim its mead from field and dell. The vales grow dry and colours quicken, the cattle low, and by the moon the nightingale pours forth its tune. How sad I find your apparition, O spring, O time of love's unrest! What sombre echoes of ambition then stir my blood and fill my breast? What tender and oppressive yearning possesses me on spring's returning, when in some quiet rural place I feel her breath upon my face? Or am I now inured to gladness, and all that quickens and excites, that sparkles, triumphs and delights, casts only spleen and languid sadness on one whose heart has long been dead, for whom but darkness lies ahead? Or saddened by the re-emergence of leaves that perished in the fall, we heed the rustling woods' resurgence as bitter losses we recall? Or do we mark with lamentation how nature's lively renovation compares with our own fading youth, for which no spring will come in truth? Perhaps in thought we reassemble within a dream to which we cling some other and more ancient spring that sets the aching heart a-tremble with visions of some distant place, a magic night, the moon's embrace. Now is the time, you hibernators, you epicures and sages, you fortunate procrastinators, you fledglings from our Lyovshin's crew, you rustic Priams from the cities, and you, my sentimental pretties, spring calls you to your country seat. It's time for flowers, labours, heat, those heady walks for which you're thirsting, and soft, seductive nights as well. Into the fields, my friends, pell-mell, load up your carriages to bursting, bring out your own or rent a horse, and far from town now set your course. You too, indulgent reader, hurry in your imported coach, I pray, to leave the city with its flurry where you spent winter time in play. And with my wilful muse, let's hustle to where the leafy woodlands rustle. A nameless river's placid scene, the country place where my Eugene, that idle and reclusive schemer, but recently this winter stayed, not far from our unhappy maid, young Tanya, my enchanted dreamer, but where he now no longer reigns, where only his sad trace remains. Where hills half circle round a valley, let's trace a winding brooklet's flow through greening fields, and watch it dally beside a spot where lindens grow. And there the nightingale, spring's lover, sings out till dawn, a crimson cover of briar blooms and freshets sound. There too a tombstone can be found beneath two pine trees, old for ages. Its legend lets the stranger know Vladimir Lensky lies below. He died too soon, his death courageous. At such an age, in such a year, repose in peace, young poet, here. There was a time when breezes playing among the pines would gently turn a secret wreath that hung there swaying upon a bough above that urn. And sometimes, in the evening hours, two maidens, used to come with flowers, and by the moonlit grave they kept their vigil, and embracing wept. But now the monument stands dreary and quite forgot. Its pathway now all weeds. No wreath is on the bough. Alone the shepherd, grey and weary, beneath it sings as in the past, and plaits his simple shoes of bast. My poor, poor Lenski. Yes, she mourned him, although her tears were all too brief. Alas, his fiancée has scorned him and proved unfaithful to her grief. Another captured her affection, another with his love's perfection has lulled her wretchedness to sleep. A lancer has enthralled her deep, a lancer whom she loves with passion, and at the altar by his side she stands beneath the crown, a bride. Her head bent down in modest fashion, her lowered eyes aflame the while, and on her lips a slender smile. Poor Lenski, in his place of resting, in deaf eternity's grim shade, did he, sad bard, awake protesting the fateful news he'd been betrayed? Or, lulled by Lethe, has he slumbered, his blissful spirit unencumbered by feelings and perturbed no more, his world a closed and silent door? Just so. The tomb that lies before us holds but oblivion in the end. The voice of lover, foe, and friend falls silent fast. Alone the chorus of angry heirs in hot debate contests obscenely our estate. Soon Olga's happy voice and beauty no longer cheered the family group. A captive of his lot and duty, her lancer had to join his troop. Dame Larin's eyes began to water as she embraced her younger daughter and, scarce alive, cried out goodbye. But Tanya found she couldn't cry. A deathly pallor merely covered her stricken face. When all came out onto the porch and fussed about while taking leave, Tatiana hovered beside the couple's coach below, then sadly saw the lovers go. And long she watched the road they'd taken, as through a mist of stifled tears. Now Tanya is alone, forsaken, companion of so many years, the darling sister whom she'd nourished, the bosom friend she'd always cherished, now carried off by fate, a bride, forever parted from her side. She roams in aimless desolation, now gazes at the vacant park, but all seems joyless, bleak, and dark. There's nothing offers consolation or brings her smothered tears relief. Her heart is rent in two by grief. And in the solitude, her passion burns even stronger than before. Her heart speaks out in urgent fashion of faraway Eugene the more. She'll never see him. And be grateful. She finds a brother's slayer hateful and loathes the awful thing he's done. The poet's gone, and hardly one remembers him. His bride's devotion has flown to someone else instead. His very memory now has fled like smoke across an azure ocean. Two hearts, perhaps, remain forlorn and mourn him yet. But wherefore mourn? 'Twas evening, and the heavens darkled. A beetle hummed. The peasant choirs were bound for home. Still waters sparkled. Across the river, smoky fires of fishermen were dimly gleaming. Tatiana walked alone and dreaming. Beneath the moonbeam's silver light, and climbed a gentle hill by night, she walked and walked, till with a shiver she spied a distant hamlet's glow. A manor house and grove below, a garden by the glinting river, and as she gazed upon that place, her pounding heart began to race. Assailed by doubts, she grew dejected. Should I go on, turn back, or what? He isn't here, I'm not expected. I'll glance at house and garden plot. And so, scarce breathing, down she hastened and looked about, perplexed and chastened to find herself at his estate. She entered the deserted gate. A pack of barking dogs chased round her, and at her frightened cry, a troop of household urchins with a whoop came rushing quickly to surround her. They made the barking hounds obey, then led the lady safe away. "May I just see the house, I wonder?" asked Tanya, and the children leapt to find Anicia and to plunder the household keys she always kept. Anicia came in just a second, and soon the open doorway beckoned. She stepped inside the empty shell where once our hero used to dwell. She found a cue left unattended upon the table after play, and on a rumpled sofa lay his riding crop. And on she wended. "And here's the hearth," spoke up the crone, "where master used to sit alone. Our neighbour Lenski, lately buried, would dine with him in winter here. Come this way, please, but don't feel hurried. And here's the master's study, dear. He slept, took coffee in these quarters, would hear the bailiff give his orders, and mornings read some book right through. My former master lived here too. On Sundays at his window station, his glasses on, he'd deign to play some cards with me to pass the day. God grant his mortal soul salvation, and may his dear old bones be blessed in Mother Earth, where he's at rest." Tatiana looks in melting pleasure at everything around the room. She finds it all a priceless treasure, a painful joy that lifts her gloom and leaves her languid soul ignited. The desk, the lamp that stands unlighted, the heap of books, the carpet spread before the window on the bed, that semi-light so pale and solemn, the view outdoors, the lunar pall, Lord Byron's portrait on the wall, the iron bust upon its column, with clouded brow beneath a hat, the arms compressed and folded flat. And long she stood, bewitched and glowing, inside that modish bachelor cell. But now it's late. The winds are blowing. It's cold and dark within the dell. The grove's asleep above the river. Behind the hill, the moon's a sliver. And now it's time indeed long past that our young pilgrim leave at last. Concealing her wrought-up condition, though not without a heartfelt sigh, Tatiana turns to say goodbye, but, taking leave, requests permission to see the vacant house alone and read the books he'd called his own. Outside the gate, Tatiana parted from old Anicia. Next day, then, she rose at dawn and off she started to see the empty house again. And once inside that silent study, sealed off at last from everybody, the world for just a time forgot, Tatiana wept and mourned her lot, then turned to see the books he'd favoured. At first she didn't wish to read. The choice of books seemed strange indeed, but soon her thirsting spirit savoured the mystery that those pages told and watched a different world unfold. Although Onegin's inclination for books had vanished, as we know, he did exempt from condemnation some works and authors, even so. The Bard of Juan and the Giaour, and some few novels done with power, in which our age is well displayed, and modern man himself portrayed with something of his true complexion, with his immoral soul disclosed, his arid vanity exposed, his endless bent for deep reflection, his cold, embittered mind that seems to waste itself in empty schemes. Some pages still preserved the traces where fingernails had sharply pressed. The girl's attentive eye embraces these lines more quickly than the rest. And Tanya sees, with trepidation, the kind of thought or observation to which Eugene paid special heed, or where he'd tacitly agreed. And in the margins she inspected his pencil marks with special care. And on those pages everywhere she found Onegin's soul reflected, in crosses or a jotted note, or in the question mark he wrote. And so, in slow but growing fashion, my Tanya starts to understand more clearly now, thank God, her passion and him for whom, by fate's command, she'd been condemned to feel desire. that dangerous and sad pariah, that work of heaven or of hell, that angel and proud fiend as well. What was he then? An imitation? An empty phantom or a joke? A Muscovite in Harold's cloak? Compendium of affectation? A lexicon of words in vogue? Mere parody? And just a rogue? Can she have solved the riddle's power? Can she have found the final clue? She hardly notes how late the hour, and back at home she's overdue, where two old friends in conversation speak out on Tanya's situation. What can I do? Tatiana's grown, Dame Larin muttered with a moan. Her younger sister married neatly. It's time that she were settled too. I swear I don't know what to do. She turns all offers down completely, just says, I can't, then broods away and wanders through those woods all day. Is she in love? With whom, I wonder? Buyanov tried. She turned him down. And Petushkov as well went under. Pikhtin, the lancer, came from town to stay with us and seemed transported. My word, that little devil courted. I thought she might accept him then, but no, the deal fell through again. Why, my dear lady, what's the bother? To Moscow and the marriage mart. They've vacancies galore, take heart. But I've so little income, father. Sufficient for one winter's stay, or borrow then, from me, let's say. The good old lady was delighted to hear such sensible advice. She checked her funds and then decided a Moscow winter would be nice. Tatiana heard the news morosely. The haughty world would watch her closely and judge her harshly from the start. Her simple, open country heart and country dress would find no mercy, and antiquated turns of phrase were sure to bring a mocking gaze from every Moscow fop and Circe. Oh, horrors! No, she'd better stay safe in her woods and never stray. With dawn's first rays, Tatiana races out to the open fields to sigh, and gazing softly, she embraces the world she loves and says goodbye. Farewell, my peaceful vales and fountains. Farewell, you too, familiar mountains and woods where once I used to roam. Farewell, celestial beauty's home. Farewell, fond nature where I flourished. I leave your world of quiet joys for empty glitter, fuss, and noise. Farewell, my freedom, deeply cherished. Oh, where and why do I now flee, and what does fate prepare for me? And all that final summer season her walks were long. A brook or knoll would stop her now for no good reason, except to charm her thirsting soul. As with old friends, she keeps returning to all her groves and meadows, yearning to talk once more and say goodbye. But quickly summer seems to fly, the golden autumn now arriving. Now nature, tremulous, turns pale, a victim draped in lavish veil. The north now howls, the winds are driving the clouds before them far and near. That sorceress, the winter's here. She's spread herself through field and fountain and hung the limbs of oaks with white. She lies atop the farthest mountain in wavy carpets glistening bright. She's levelled with a fluffy blanket both river and the shores that flank it. The frost has gleamed, and we give thanks for Mother Winter's happy pranks. But Tanya's heart is far from captured. She doesn't greet the winter's glow, inhale the frost dust, gather snow from bathhouse roof to wash, enraptured, her shoulders, face and breast. With dread she views the winter path ahead. Departure day was long expected. The final hours come at last. The covered sleigh, for years neglected, is checked, relined, and soon made fast. The usual three-cart train will carry what household goods are necessary, the mattresses, the trunks and chairs, some jars of jam and kitchen wares, the feather beds and coops of chickens, some pots and basins and the rest. Well, almost all that they possessed. The servants fussed and raised the dickens about the stable. Many cried. Then 18 nags were led outside. They're harnessed to the coach and steadied. The cooks make lunch for one and all. The heaped-up wagons now are readied. The wenches and the drivers brawl. Atop a lean and shaggy trotter, the bearded postboy sits as spotter. Retainers crowd the gate pell-mell to bid their mistresses farewell. They're all aboard. And, slowly gliding, the ancient coach creeps out the gate. Farewell, my peaceful home and fate. Farewell, secluded place of hiding. Shall I return? And Tanya sighs as tears well up to dim her eyes. When we have broadened education, the time will come, without a doubt, by scientific computation, within 500 years about, when our old roads' decayed condition will change beyond all recognition. Paved highways linking every side will cross our Russia far and wide. Above our waters, iron bridges will stride in broadly arching sweep. We'll dig bold tunnels neath the deep and even part whole mountain ridges, and Christendom will institute an inn at every stage en route. But roads are bad now in our nation. Neglected bridges rot and fall. Bedbugs and fleas at every station won't let the traveller sleep at all. No inns exist. At posting stages they hang pretentious menu pages, but just for show, as if to spite the traveller's futile appetite. While some rude cyclops at his fire treats Europe's dainty artifacts with mighty Russian hammer wax, and thanks the Lord for ruts and mire and all the ditches that abound throughout our native Russian ground. And yet a trip in winter season is often easy, even nice. Like modish verse devoid of reason, the winter road is smooth as ice. Our bold automedons stay cheery, our Russian troikas never weary, and mileposts soothe the idle eye as fence-like they go flashing by. Unluckily, Dame Larin wasted no funds on renting fresher horse, which meant a longer trip, of course, and so our maiden fully tasted her share of travel's dull delights. They rode for 7 days and nights. But now they're near. Before them, gleaming, lies Moscow, with its stones of white, its ancient domes and spires streaming with golden crosses, ember bright. Ah, friends, I too have been delighted when all at once, far off, I've sighted that splendid view of distant domes, of churches, belfries, stately homes. How oft, forlorn and separated, when wayward fate has made me stray, I've dreamt of Moscow far away. Ah, Moscow, how that sound is freighted with meaning for our Russian hearts. How many echoes it imparts. And here's Petrovsky Castle, hoary amid its park. In sombre dress it wears with pride its recent glory. Napoleon, drunk with fresh success, awaited here in vain surrender for kneeling Moscow's hand to tender the ancient Kremlin's hallowed keys. But Moscow never bent her knees, nor bowed her head in subjugation. No welcome feast did she prepare, the restless hero waiting there, but lit instead a conflagration. From here he watched, immersed in thought, the awesome blaze my Moscow wrought. Farewell now, scene of fame unsteady, Petrovsky Castle. Hey, be fleet, there gleam the city gates already. And now along Tverskaya Street the sleigh glides over ruts and passes by sentry booths and peasant lasses, by gardens, mansions, fashion shops, past urchins, street lamps, strolling fops, bokharins, sleighs, apothecaries, mujiks and merchants, Cossack guards, past towers, hovels, boulevards, great balconies and monasteries, past gateway lions' lifted paws and crosses dense with flocks of doors. This tiring trek through town extended for 2 full hours. Then, quite late, nearby St. Chariton's, it ended before a mansion's double gate. For now, they'll seek accommodation with Tanya's aunt, a kind relation, 4 years consumptive, sad to note. In glasses and a torn old coat, a grizzled Kalmuk came to meet them. With sock in hand, he led the way to where the prostrate princess lay. She called from parlour couch to greet them. The 2 old ladies hugged and cried, with shouts of joy on either side. "Princesse, mon ange, Pechette! Oh, Laura, who would have thought how long it's been! I hope you'll stay. Dear cousin Laura, sit down. Ah, strange, I can't begin. I'd swear it's from some novel's pages. And here's my Tanya. Lord, it's ages. Oh, Tanya, sweet, come over here. I think I must be dreaming, dear. Oh, cousin, do you still remember your Grandison? I never knew. Oh, Grandison, of course I do. He lives in Moscow. This December, on Christmas Eve, he paid a call. He married off his son this fall. The other... But we'll talk tomorrow, and straightway, too, to all her kin we'll show your Tanya. What a sorrow that paying visits does me in. I drag about like some poor laggard. But here, your trip has left you haggard. Let's all go have a nice long rest. I've got no strength. This weary breast finds even joy at times excessive, not only woe. It's true, my dear. I'm good for nothing now, I fear. When one gets old, life turns oppressive.
And all worn out, she wept a bit, then broke into a coughing fit.
The sick old lady's kindly smile left Tanya moved, but she felt sad within this strange new domicile and missed the room she had always had. In bed, beneath her silken curtain, she lies there sleepless and uncertain. And early church bells, when they chime, announcing dawn and working time, rouse Tanya from her bed to listen. She sits before the windowsill. The darkness wanes, but Tanya still can't see her fields and valleys glisten. She sees an unknown yard instead, a stable, fence, and kitchen shed. And now they trundle Tanya daily to family dinners, just to share with granddams and granduncles gaily her languid and abstracted air. Those kin who've come from distant places are always met with warm embraces, with shouts of joy and welcome cheer. How Tanya's grown! It seems, my dear, so short a time since I baptized you. And since I dried your baby tears.
And since I pulled you by the ears.
And since my gingerbread surprised you. And with one voice the grannies cry, "Good gracious, how the years do fly!"
In them, though, nothing ever alters. The same old patterns still are met. Old Aunt Elena never falters and wears that same tulle bonnet yet. Still powdered is Lukeria Lvovna, a liar still, Lyubov Petrovna, Ivan Petrovich, no more bright, Semyon Petrovich, just as tight, and Anna Pavlovna, as ever, still has her friend Monsieur Finmouche, her same old spouse and same old pooch, her husband, clubman come whatever, is just as meek and deaf, it's true, and still consumes enough for two. Their daughters, after brief embraces, look Tanya over, good and slow. In silence, Moscow's youthful graces examine her from head to toe. They find her stranger than expected, a bit provincial and affected, and somewhat pale, too thin and small, but on the whole, not bad at all. Then, bowing to innate compassion, they squeeze her hand, and in the end take Tanya in and call her friend. They fluff her curls in latest fashion, and in their sing-song tones impart their girlish secrets of the heart. Both others and their own successes, their hopes and pranks and maiden dreams, all innocence, their talk progresses, though now and then some gossip gleams. And then they ask, in compensation for their sweet flow of revelation, for her confessions of romance. But Tanya, in a kind of trance, attends their giddy conversation without response and takes no part. And all the while she guards her heart with silence and in meditation. Her cherished trove of tears and bliss she'll share with none aloud like this. Tatiana tries to pay attention when in the parlour guests converse, but all they ever seem to mention is incoherent rot, or worse. They seem so pallid and so weary, and even in their slander dreary. In all the sterile words they use, in arid gossip, questions, news, not once all day does thought but flicker, not even in some chance remark. The languid mind will find no spark, the heart no cause to beat the quicker, and even simple-minded fun this hollow world has learned to shun. Archival dandies in a cluster eye Tanya with a priggish frown, and with their usual sort of bluster among themselves they put her down. One melancholy joker found her his true ideal and hovered round her, then, leaning by the door, prepared an elegy to show he cared. Once Vyazemsky sat down beside her, on meeting her at some dull aunt's, and managed to dispel her trance. And some old man, when he espied her, put straight his wig and asked around about this unknown belle he'd found. But where Melpomene still stages her stormy scenes and wails aloud, and in her gaudy mantle rages before the dull and frigid crowd, where sweet Thalia calmly dozes, indifferent to admirers' roses, where just Terpsichore enchants the youthful lover of the dance, as was the case, for nothing passes in our day too, let's not forget, no jealous lady trained lorgnette, no modish connoisseur his glasses to spy on Tanya down below, from boxes rising row on row. They take her to the grand assembly, and there the crush, the glare, the heat, the music's roar, the ballroom trembling, the whirling flash of pairs of feet, the beauties in their filmy dresses, the swarming gallery throng that presses the host of girls on marriage hunts, assault the senses all at once. Here practice dandies bow and slither to show their gall, and waistcoats too, with negligent lorgnettes in view. Hussars on leave come racing hither to strut their stuff and thunder by, to dazzle, conquer, and to fly. The night has countless stars to light her, and Moscow countless beauties too. And yet the regal moon shines brighter than all her friends in heaven's blue, and she, whose beauty I admire, but dare not bother with my lyre, just like the moon upon her throne, mid wives and maidens, shines alone. With what celestial pride she grazes the earth she walks in splendour dressed. What languor fills her lovely breast, how sensuous her wondrous gazes. But there, enough, have done at last. You've paid your due to follies past. Commotion, bows, the glad, the solemn, gallop, mazurka, waltz, and there between two aunts, beside a column, observed by none and near despair, Tatiana looks with eyes unseeing and loathes this world with all her being. She's stifled here, and in her mind calls up the life she left behind. The countryside, poor village neighbours, a distant and secluded nook beside a limpid flowing brook, her flowers, novels, daily labours, that dusky linden-shaded walk where he and she once had their talk. And so, far off in thought, she wandered. The monde, the noisy ball, forgot. But all the while, as Tania pondered, some generals stared her way a lot. The aunts exchanged a wink and nodded, and with an elbow each one prodded Tatiana, whispering in her ear, "Look quickly to your left, my dear." "My left? But why? It seems like gawking." "Just never mind. Now, look up there. That group in front. You see that pair in uniform? The one not talking? He just moved off. He's turning round." "That heavy general?" Tania frowned. But here let's honour with affection my Tania's conquest taking wing, and steer for now a new direction, lest I forget of whom I sing, on which herewith these observations. I sing strange whims and aberrations. I sing a youthful friend of mine. Oh, muse of epics, may you shine on my long work as I grow older, and armed with your good staff, I pray, may I not roam too far astray. Enough, the burden's off my shoulder. To classicism I've been true. The foreword's here, if overdue.